This is Transported. In this episode, I'm going to try and break down my own thoughts on the wider geopolitical context in which the events of the 7th of October happened. It's now a full 10 weeks since then, and I think people are still struggling to understand what on earth happened and why. Those who are acting and thinking in bad faith believe that it can only be explained by some kind of conspiracy theory, that somehow this was a false flag operation, or we did it to ourselves by weakening the border and knowing Hamas would come across. There's all sorts of wild stuff out there, or at least it appears wild to us. But there are many people who find it believable because the alternative, the likely truth of the situation, feels so implausible. And in many ways, psychologically, it's worse if we just took our eye off the ball, if we just screwed this up, than if there was some sinister hand at play on our side that made it all happen. What I'm going to posit over what may be an hour, so I'm warning you now, is that there is a sinister hand at play. It isn't that of Netanyahu or some Israeli deep state. It is also not a conspiracy of that greater Satan, America. But there are going to be some very familiar actors in the story that I'm going to present to you here. The good news is that if my analysis of this is correct, and if the parties who have been wronged in what happened on October the 7th, which are many more parties than just the Israelis and the poor unfortunate civilians of Gaza, then there is the possibility of something positive coming out of this. This is also a good time to mention that I am, of course, an amateur, not an expert on any of this. No one's paying me to record this episode. I have not worked for, nor do I plan to work for, any governments, any think tanks, and I'm just presenting the analysis that is completely of my own. I don't expect it to go anywhere in particular. These are just my musings. I think it's important in the current tense atmosphere to make it clear what my agenda is, where my background is, etc., etc. So I appreciate your forbearance. Here goes. You can go back as far as you like in Israeli-Palestinian history and point to whichever spot in the so-called cycle of violence you like to try and justify whatever your claims are. So I don't want to revisit too much history here, but a little context is important. Hamas came to power in the Gaza Strip in 2007, having won the majority in the legislative elections across the whole of the Palestinian Authority. There was a kind of civil war which resulted in Hamas seizing full control of Gaza and Fatah under Mahmoud Abbas taking control in the West Bank. Netanyahu is on some kind of record as stating that the situation of having a Hamas in Gaza and a Fatah in the West Bank was actually quite convenient because it meant that it was impossible to be pushed into a two-state solution kind of peace process because the existence of Hamas essentially meant that was a non-starter. It's fair to say that, to a great degree, Hamas have been a rational and stable actor. There was the negotiation with them over the release of prisoners in exchange for Gilad Shalit, which is obviously rather a hot topic at the moment, given that firstly, some of those prisoners participated in October the 7th, in fact, perhaps even in its entire inception and planning. And of course, please God, with the safe release of several dozen of the hostages currently held in Gaza since October the 7th. We also know that, of course, there was the granting of tens of thousands of work permits so that ordinary Gazans could get better paid jobs inside Israel proper. And indeed, some of the people who helped with the intelligence for October the 7th and perhaps even participated had been people who just the previous week would have been at work in the exact communities that were then obliterated on October the 7th. We also know that one of the reasons why Qatar is able to act as a mediator is because of their close links with Hamas leadership, some of whom live in great luxury in Qatar itself, and that Qatar, with the agreement of the Israeli government, have been providing suitcases full of cash, I mean literally suitcases that were driven across the border of cash, to support Hamas as a civil government in the Gaza Strip. Now, of course, theoretically, that cash was not supposed to be used for terror, but I think we all understand that there were no real safeguards that could ensure that would happen, just as all of the concrete that was supposed to go for building in Gaza went for tunnels, just as so much of the piping that was supposed to go for sewerage went into rockets and so on. These are all things that obviously need to be corrected whenever this conflict finishes and we try to do something different. We simply can't allow this to happen again on a logistical basis. We may not be able to squash the idea of Hamas, but I think we can have a much better go at making it harder for them to implement their ideas. So one of the reasons why October the 7th happened the way that it was is because the government had a very clear idea that they had a stable relationship with Hamas and that as a rational actor they wouldn't do anything that would greatly change the facts on the ground. Yes, periodically they'll fire some rockets. Yes, occasionally they'll try to infiltrate the border. But broadly speaking, these are things that, firstly, there are factions within Hamas that might want to do this for reasons of, shall we say, domestic politics. And secondly, as an overall organization, why on earth would they risk the gains that they had already made? That was the viewpoint. There's an extent to which, therefore, the decision was made to secure the border using largely signals intelligence, and a lot of the human intelligence that we previously had in Gaza has been eroded by the exact hermetic sealing of the border between Israel and Gaza that is supposed to keep us safe. So you can already see a picture being painted here of how October the 7th happened. An assumption that Hamas was a rational actor, albeit one that was technically hell-bent on our destruction, but probably wouldn't really try such a thing. And that we didn't have the kind of security apparatus in place because it was focused elsewhere where we believed it to be more important, whether it's human intelligence in the West Bank, whether it's a bigger military presence on the northern border because of the presence of Hezbollah, not to mention the border with Syria and active intervention within Syria against the transshipment of weaponry for Hezbollah. This is a good moment to think about what on earth it means to be a rational actor. It's very clear that Hamas have always been an extremely ideologically driven organization. The kind of level of Jew hatred that they espouse, not just in thought and word, but indeed, demonstrates that these people are not, by Western standards, rational. I think, though, that the reality of that kind of ideology is that you may not be able to be understood by the West. It may seem that you're driven by this pure bloodlust. But actually, by the standards of the Middle East and by the standards of that type of morality, the actions that they took on the 7th of October and that they have taken consistently since they became a terrorist organization some 40 odd years ago is completely rational from their perspective because it has a rational goal. The goal is dismantle the state of Israel, chase out or preferably exterminate the Jews, and then be able to sit in control of the land, and to do so not just because who doesn't want to be in control of the land, but because Allah said so, and because this is all previously Muslim lands, and that therefore there is a Quranic edict that it should be returned to being under the control of Muslims. From their perspective, this is all entirely rational stuff. And I think that it's important to understand that in this context. It's also doubly important because there are other actors who are pushing what Hamas are doing. You know, it's a running joke that Iran is willing to defend the Palestinians down to the last Palestinian. That kind of thinking has been the way in which most of the Arab and the Muslim world have sought to take on Israel. In practice, they probably have no real interest to put their own skin in the game. They don't want to spend too much of their own blood and treasure, but they're perfectly happy to see the Palestinians essentially commit a series of own goals rather than actually tell them, listen, this conflict is over. We lost collectively, and yes, you lost specifically, and Israel has won. This has always been my analysis of the problem in the Middle East. The Arab and Muslim side has never accepted that they have been defeated, and the Jewish-Israeli side has never accepted that it has won. So we have failed to secure a peace because we have never really driven home our advantage in technological, financial, military, diplomatic, intellectual, moral, whatever you want to call it. We've never taken that advantage and said, that's it, you're done. And these are our terms. And in fact, we can talk about what I think should have happened on October the 8th, and it will give you a clearer idea of how we should be taking home these kind of advantages. Let's firstly talk about why 7/10 and why that day, or why this moment in time. As I said, Hamas is both a rational actor by Western standards and an irrational one. But it is, as I said, always rational in its own ideological context. The powers that sit behind Hamas, most notably Iran, but to some extent, other Muslim countries or Arab countries, such as Qatar, Turkey, and also non-Muslim and Arab countries, such as Russia and, to a degree, China, which we will come to, they all have their own agendas at play here. Now, I'm not going to tell you anything that hasn't already been said in the public domain somewhere if you just know where to look for it. I think that the timing of all of this was quite propitious. I think something much bigger was afoot. Just a few weeks before October the 7th, there was not only this prospect of a Saudi-Israel peace accord that would see the Saudis joining the Abraham Accords, which effectively would have started to drag most of the Arab League, if not de jure and fully and openly, into the Abraham Accords, but certainly de facto to stop menacing Israel in the way that a lot of these countries have wanted to, stop a lot of the saber rattling, perhaps start to see these countries have less of an agenda within some of the big fora like the United Nations. Who knows where it could have ended up with the Saudis officially on board. It's why Bibi, as a pretty shrewd mover within the Israeli political scene, was very keen to have an accord with the Saudis, because it probably would have been his get out of jail free card within Israeli domestic politics to say, look, I've done this. This is the note on which I'm going to retire, and I'm leaving Israel in a better place, and we can all overlook whatever the allegations are about my personal misdemeanors. And that probably would have worked. I think that at this point, most of the left and right would have said, okay, fair time to leave. Go out on a high and be able to be celebrated in the same breath as a Menachem Begin for making peace with Anwar Sadat and the Egyptians, etc. Obviously, all of those dynamics have changed post 7th of October. There is a slight chance that Bibi may be able to redeem himself somewhat by still concluding those accords, and we will come back to why that is even more important today than it was before. Here's the bit that you may not have read quite so much about. At the same time as, and in my view, inherently connected with the Saudi-Israel negotiation, was a Saudi-Indian negotiation with substantial assistance from the Americans. It seems to me that the objective of that negotiation was to create a serious alternative to China's Belt and Road project, which, as I say, that's a matter of public reporting. But it seems obvious to me that the idea was to actively disrupt, if not dismantle, BRICS, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, as a, I would say, nascent Warsaw Pact, at least let's call it an economic pact, but it's also an ideological pact. And there are extents to which one does wonder if it is also a military pact before it really turns into something major. Now, there's a BRICS summit coming up in January, and several more countries, including Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Argentina, were all supposed to really formally join BRICS as some kind of organization. It seems quite obvious to me that there was an American and probably European imperative to make sure that that doesn't turn into anything more than a talking shop, which is what it's been so far. There's been, as we know, a Cold War between China and the US that has been simmering for some while. So far, thank goodness, it's been an economic war. But there are clearly two different worldviews at play, and we have been living in a pretty much unipolar system, and the Chinese are not happy about that. They want to create something with a second pole led by them. This is aligned with the Russia-Ukraine war, which again is about the creation of two different systems at the end of the day. This is Russia taking the last chance that they probably have from a demographic and military and economic perspective to grab territory and to expand their borders back to what they believe to be something that is not just militarily defensible, but demographically and economically more viable than just the rump of Russia that they were left with the collapse of the Soviet Union. So what we're seeing are the new battle lines of a new version of the Warsaw Pact versus NATO and the West being drawn. BRICS was a sort of economic tool for that to happen. And as that has started to crystallize into real foreign policy with real military implications, and that is starting to have genuine economic consequences on the West, I think that the West is starting to push back. And it's also doing so because inside the West, we are seeing the rise of a group of younger generation people who they don't seem to remember the Cold War because they weren't born, and they don't seem to have done enough learning about what it was and what it represented. In fact, what they have learned is that Che Guevara is some kind of sexist symbol to put on your T-shirts, and that the hammer and sickle, which in my mind represents nearly as much barbarism and cruelty as a swastika, is also a badge of honour. And these cretins don't really have any grasp of history or morality, none of it. And there's a good argument that, of course, they are being fomented by the powers that sit on the other side from us. That's an entire podcast on its own. Now, all of that is relevant here, because what I think is happening is that the fear of the BRICS turning into this new Warsaw Pact has suddenly come to a head. Already there were moves among the West to say, you know what, we can't work out how to get a lot of these countries, especially in the Middle East, to be both meritocratic, democratic, modernizing states all at the same time. It's too much to do. So we're going to start with them being modernizing. We're going to hope that they become somewhat meritocratic, and all that democracy stuff can come at the end. And that's partly why everyone's made such an effort to bend over backwards for MBS, even though we know he's an individually deeply unpleasant and unsavory character. That much is obvious from the whole Khashoggi incident. So we've brought them into the family of nations, and it's also true to say that the UAE don't have an amazing human rights record. Yes, we've had a good go at Qatar over the thousands of workers that they employed as virtual slaves to build everything for the World Cup, but the rest of the Gulf isn't exactly much better. But we've learned to tolerate it in the grand scheme of things. This is the ultimate realpolitik. So the decision to pull India out of BRICS, which is the effective reality of what would have happened, by creating this alternative Belt and Road, this land train through Saudi Arabia with the support of the UAE, across Jordan and into Israel, and then on to the Mediterranean. And in turn, that would mean through Israel's close partnership with Greece and Cyprus into the EU. That was a clear statement of intent that actually we don't want to see another Warsaw Pact, East versus West kind of structure. And if that is going to happen, we don't want to run the risk of these large countries either being technically non-aligned or actively choosing to be in the side of the bad guys, for lack of a better word. And they are the bad guys, make no mistake about it. They stand against so many of our values. And even though there are certain things which I'm sure people can argue, well, you know, it's better over there because you don't get woke people in China and Russia. That's true, but I would rather take my chances in a system where we can defeat that kind of ideology at the ballot box and in the press through public discourse than be in a scenario where that ideology doesn't exist, but nor does any other ideology that disagrees with the way that the state is running. I know where I would rather be, however hard that fight is. And it's a shame that these same people don't seem to appreciate that. All of this is to say that it was in the direct interests of China, Russia, and therefore to a large extent Iran as their proxy and also a participant on the sidelines of this kind of BRICS structure, to make sure that India was not pulled away into this alternative axis, that it was not aligned with the West and more Western values and economic structures. There was a point at which the Saudis were talking about not having purely dollarized payments for their oil exports, and all of that would go away under this kind of deal. It's done under the American aegis. It's quite obvious that there's some quid pro quos at play here. Part of that was to do with arming Saudi Arabia with the latest weaponry. Yes, we could all fear that that might be used against Israel, but it was quite obvious that that was because Saudi Arabia has very much understood the threat of Iran. Now, I think the Saudis are very smart. A few months ago, there was a Chinese brokered deal to help the Saudis and Iranians to deal with each other. Now, that deal is kind of a paper tiger. I think that it was done really kind of with great fanfare because the Saudis wanted to do something to chivvy the Americans into backing them more fully and making them present an alternative. And that indeed seems to have worked. So I don't put any great store by that rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I think that was just a tactical move by different parties. It suited everyone, all three of those participants, to do it. I don't think it has any great value. It was just supposed to be a precursor, as far as the Chinese were concerned, to getting the Saudis into BRICS and away from the American sphere. And the Saudis let it happen because they understood that it would actually put a shot across the bows of the Americans to stop all of this moralizing over MBS chopping up one journalist, which does not a foreign policy make. And that's what they do to people who cross their path in the wrong way. And that and again, this is a little brutal to say, is why at the end of this process we need to have a deal where Arab states like Saudi Arabia and the UAE have genuine skin in the game in Gaza and probably across the whole of the Palestinian territories to make sure that there are some serious sticks as well as the necessary carrots of a peace process. That's just the way it seems to operate in the Middle East, and I don't believe that Israel is capable, either from our own perspectives or because the world will ever allow us to wield those same sticks, and I'm not sure that we should. There are others who are quite happy to, because that fits within their worldview and within their moral plane. Let them do so on our behalf. Let them do so on everyone's behalf. And above all, let them do so on behalf of the genuine, ordinary Palestinians who just want to go about their lives and who are not looking to make this kind of trouble. They're not looking to be extremists. So the best thing we can do, potentially, is to have these kind of partners, walking softly and carrying a big stick, as the phrase goes. So we can also see from India's reaction, which normally is somewhat muted on this issue of anything that happens in the Middle East, the Indian government and the Indian people have been remarkably openly pro-Israel during the entire last 6.5 weeks. And that doesn't just happen on its own. That's happening because there is an understanding at their end about the direction that all of this was traveling. And there's a clear eagerness on behalf of Modi and the Indian government for them to step out of being in the same group as China, where it's pretty obvious to them that they are the most uneasy and unnatural bedfellows. India sees itself as and prides itself on being a democracy, and they want that to be in a Western style. And yes, I know that Modi is a populist, but there is just no sense that even as a populist, he's really looking to undermine the broad concept of democracy in India. It's one of the things that allows them to have, as they would see it, a moral edge over China as one of the world's rising superpowers. That's not to justify any particular action of the Indian government. For example, this assassination of an activist in Canada, which seems to be pretty abhorrent. You have to take these things on balance. Would I rather on balance have India on my side than Russia and China? Absolutely, I would. It doesn't mean that India are the perfect partner. And in fact, one of the things that you do by trying to pull them into your side of this division is to try and give them every incentive to play by the rules-based world order as best as everybody can make them. And again, I feel like you have to caveat everything these days. Yes, I know the CIA have killed people, blah, 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 extrajudicial, blah, blah, blah. I get that. Suffice it to say, this is about trying to get the best countries available to at least align with each other. It's not to say that every country is going to be perfect. And of course, we can throw Israel into that mix as well. Certainly under the current government, things are not ideal. It's one of the reasons why this disaster befell Israel in the first place. Just to give a synopsis of what I think about that, this probably could be a podcast in its own right, but I don't believe that either side have been correct over this issue. I think that you cannot possibly have judicial reform without electoral, constitutional, and legislative reform at the same time, because all four are interlinked. The reason why the courts have assigned to themselves far too much power, albeit I think they use it more responsibly than the right gives them credit for, is because we have a unicameral system and a direct proportional representation system that means that extreme parties have a tendency to be able to lead the Knesset in directions that are further to the left or the right than they might otherwise be, and because the executive comes straight out of the legislature in terms that whoever has the largest party or can best form a coalition becomes the government of the day, and their leader is the prime minister and their cabinet comes from there. In addition to that, because there's no constitution, there's only a set of basic laws that don't really have any value beyond fairly standard other laws, it becomes pretty easy to understand why the only check and balance that's available has become the courts. My view is both sides need to sit down and accept that there are much bigger fish to fry than just judicial reform. It's everything together has to be dealt with in that way. It's the only way to move forward to create a more modern structure for a state, especially because we live in a changing demographic reality, and every side needs to agree that the premises of pluralism and a small L liberal democracy are actually sacrosanct, and that can only be done now. If you wait any longer, you start to entrench too many parties, particularly on what we broadly still call the right, that will act in their own self-interest rather than the interests of the plurality. It becomes necessary to firstly enshrine the concept of pluralism in the structures of law and of the legislative process. It's also necessary for us to start sending the right kind of messages into these communities that it is not in your long-term interests to act purely for yourselves. All that you will do is weaken the fabric of the state, and a lot of the benefits that you get from that state will go away if you actually have your way, ironically enough. This could be an entire podcast on its own, so I'm not going to dwell on it. What I would say is, it seems fairly inconceivable to me that if all parties had been focused on some of the more important things in running a state and not this insane level of internal division, then perhaps this was somewhat unavoidable, but I think the response certainly would have been more coherent and there was an opportunity for cooler heads to prevail. Hamas have talked very openly about how Israel appeared to be vulnerable because of these internecine conflicts, and that's also what Hezbollah have said, it's what Iran have said. So I'm inclined to take them at their word that they saw Israel as being materially at one of its weakest points. And in the art of war, what you learn is that sometimes you can't get the enemy at a most absolute weak moment. You just have to choose its relatively weak moment and your relatively strongest point. And I think that that is why this attack happened at the moment that it did. It is difficult to see a situation where Russia could be much less popular on the world stage. It's also hard to imagine that once Saudi Arabia, India, Israel, and so on have all made an alliance, that that alliance is going to be particularly easy to shake. You only need to look at the Abraham Accords to see that, apart from a few nasty words in the press and at the United Nations, actually, these countries have, broadly speaking, stuck by Israel despite their own street. It's a good sign. So to summarize this entire first half hour of me talking, what we're at here is that Israel was at a point of substantial internal weakness, but because of this nascent peace accord and what was sitting behind it, it was about to flip that into a position of substantial external strength, and one would have to assume that it would have led to more domestic accord as part of what Netanyahu would have necessarily had to do, which is to get broad support to get this deal through. And that might have required some kind of unity government or special vote that would have led to an election. As I say, my guess is that Bibi would have made a deal that he gets this Saudi thing done and then he retires from public life and gets the criminal charges dropped. That's the kind of thing that was being whispered about behind closed doors and starting to make it into the public arena before, obviously, 7/10 changed all of our realities. So that's why 7/10 happened, and that's why it happened when it did. One must also add that stories have come out that I have no reason to disbelieve, that several hundred of these Hamas terrorists were trained in Iran, and that this was an operation that was absolutely not spontaneous. It was a couple of years in the planning. I suspect, however, that for Israel's incredible technologically advanced border to be overwhelmed in the way that it did, this cannot just have been Hamas and probably not even just Iran. There's already plenty of evidence that's come out to show that Russian proxies like the Wagner Group have been helping to supply Hamas with more sophisticated weaponry. We're seeing the first use of thermobaric munitions, for example, in Gaza by Hamas. It would seem logical to me, therefore, that on the 7th of October, when Putin woke up, and it was his birthday, by the way, I always think this symbolism is very interesting. It's not like he thought, oh, my luck is in. My great enemies are all being smashed to pieces. It's wonderful. It doesn't seem very plausible to me. It's much more likely that he knew exactly what was going on and had his finger in the pie. That's to say that there were probably some technological countermeasures that the Russians were, through proxies, supplying to Hamas, probably via Iran as an extra layer of distance between them and the realities on the ground. But that might go some way to explaining how so many systems failed, how drones that we didn't know they had appeared, how they were so technologically advanced to be able to take out control towers, watchtowers, all sorts of things happened that just, it's implausible to think that Hamas could have done completely on their own or even with Iranian backing. Tactics were on display which are straight out of the Russia-Ukraine war playbook. This brings us to something else. There are obviously these conspiracy theories about how undefended the border seemed, but in fact the border was very heavily defended. It was just being defended in the wrong kind of way. One of the things that the Israeli government is not talking about, and there are a good couple of reasons why, is that of the 1,200 odd people that died, somewhere over 300 do seem to have been soldiers. Now, what that suggests is that actually there were plenty of soldiers at the border. They were overrun by sheer force of arms, withering fire with incredible accuracy, with weaponry that Israel had no idea that Hamas had, or they would have had better defenses against them. The fact of the deaths of all of these soldiers does tell us that it's not like the border was totally undefended or indefensible. It just required even more manpower than Israel had made available. I think this point is quite useful because what it shows you is that this was a huge premeditated attack with a level of unprecedented sophistication that could only have been put together with serious outside help. So it could be that the Israeli government is not talking about it for a couple of reasons. One is they don't want to be seen to be escalating this and pointing the finger too directly at anyone other than Iran, although I'm sure that they know that there is another actor sitting behind this, at least one other actor. Now, quite early on, there were some intelligence reports that came out that suggested some possible involvement of the Wagner Group, which of course were largely dismissed or ignored by a lot of people because some of the sources were Ukrainian and it was obvious why they might have an agenda to say so. But at various times, including just a few weeks ago, the US government has said quite clearly that they believe that there is some relationship between, say, the Wagner Group and Hezbollah, to the extent that Wagner may be training Hezbollah in better anti-aircraft defense. And I think we should all be pretty concerned about the implications of that escalation and the idea that somehow Russia and Putin are nowhere near it and Wagner are really independent, especially in the light of him knocking off their leader. I noticed that Nikki Haley got absolutely schmeißed for daring to suggest that there might be some Russian or Wagner involvement in what's going on. I think the nuances of this actually do matter because on the day of the 7th of October, whilst it's true that 800 or 900 civilians died who were absolutely non-combatants, there were also over 300 Israeli military casualties. Now, many of those casualties were at bases that were overrun. There is a report that has just come out that suggests possibly some of the people who were on these bases were faced with gas attacks. I mean, some really horrific stuff took place, and most of these people were not armed, albeit they were soldiers. But nonetheless, I think we can probably all just about stomach morally the idea that attacking an army base and trying to kill the personnel of an army base, that's a reasonably legitimate target in a war. That probably wouldn't constitute an act of terrorism, much as we may find it abhorrent, especially the killing of people who Hamas, because of the intelligence it appeared they had, probably knew were unarmed even on that base, and especially the method of doing so. I think it is incumbent on us to be open about the difference between military casualties on our side and civilian casualties on our side on October the 7th itself. Another thing that seems to have been largely overlooked is the sheer volume of Hamas casualties in the initial and then over the next couple of days response by the IDF and armed civilians and so on. It seems that well over 1,000 Hamas terrorists or other people who chose to take advantage of the situation and come over and have some blood sport and some looting, they left a lot of bodies behind. It isn't exactly clear how many. One of the reasons why Israel adjusted down its own casualty figures is because it took a long time to work out just how many of the people they thought were Israeli dead were actually Hamas dead. All of these things do make a difference because they lead us to understand a little better about the complexion of what happened and why. as mentioned, this is not an undefended border or where there was the level of catastrophe of failing that people are talking about. Yes, it was awful, but in practice, on the day of the attack itself, thousands and thousands of people came across the border. Over 1,000 of them were quite rightly killed before they could go back. We lost 300 soldiers and we lost 800 or 900 civilians, all of which is awful. But I think it is a slightly different complexion from the idea that everybody who died on our side was a civilian, or that it was the totally unmitigated disaster which the other side are crowing about and which we are busy tearing ourselves apart over because we believe that we've lost all deterrence and that nothing on the day actually worked. It's true that most of the systems failed, but it's an important distinction. I think that what we're really struggling to get our heads around is something a little different. It's that it's actually impossible for the Israeli government, and possibly any government, to provide any watertight defense of a civilian population against a group of people who are only interested in the slaughter of said civilians and are willing to do absolutely anything to try and achieve their outcome, including being pretty callous about losing their own lives and obviously extremely callous about any repercussions for their own civilians. In that light, we also have to consider what we did after 7th of October in responding in Gaza. And even if the Hamas figures of 20,000 plus dead are to be believed, we have to take with a pinch of salt just how many of those were actually civilians, as in genuinely civilians, as opposed to Hamas operatives masquerading as civilians, civilians with Hamas sympathies, supporting Hamas in various practical ways, and so on. One of the things I've also noticed is that in a population of 2.3 million with a life expectancy of 75 or so years old, you would have expected that just in the last 2.5 months, there should have been some 6,000 or 7,000 civilian deaths by natural causes. It is not beyond the realm of possibility that Hamas have just thrown all of those figures into the number of dead. There doesn't seem to be any breakout of any kind of who these dead are. But if you were to take the number of people they do not identify as women and children, subtract the probability of these several thousand people who died of natural causes, and then you get roughly back to the same 7,000 men of fighting age that Israel says it has killed, that it believes were Hamas terrorists. I also take into account the roughly 10% massaging of the figures that Hamas usually manages to do in these conflicts, and the likelihood that several hundred deaths were as a result of misfiring Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas rockets, as we saw with the infamous hospital incident. So the next thing that happened after 7/10 was that as Israel started to prepare its response and to fire the first shots of that response, the Americans and British sent carrier groups, fully armed, towards the coast of Israel, as a very clear message to Hezbollah and Iran to stay the hell out of this conflict. And it's difficult to know whether that is the reason why, broadly speaking, Hezbollah and Iran have stayed out of this conflict. The other thing that it should do is, it's a positive and a negative. It was very reassuring to know that two of Israel's major allies, with the first and third most powerful navies in the world, had shown up at the doorstep and said, yep, we're going to look after you guys. It was also extremely concerning that that might have been absolutely necessary for the security of the state of Israel, that we really didn't have it covered if there was a full second front that would have opened up. And everyone knows that Hezbollah are probably far better armed and better trained than even Hamas. And of course, the border is much, much less defensible than just a few miles of the Gaza Strip. And that's before we talk about Iranian proxies and other terror organizations in the West Bank, which is definitely much more accessible to the soft underbelly of Israel, which is 8 miles wide at its narrowest point between the sea and the Green Line. So why did Hezbollah sit it out? This is quite an interesting question in its own right. One of the things I've been pondering is whether Nasrallah really takes direct orders from Tehran, or is he more extreme than they are, or less extreme than they are? And this comes back a little bit to this question of who is a rational actor. I think that we have been assuming that the political class in Iran are rational actors, and then there is this extremist elite who run the Revolutionary Guard, who are represented by the Ayatollah, and they're pretty crazy. I think that might be a somewhat reasonable understanding of the balance of power in Iran, and that whatever it is that the extremists want to do, the pragmatists in the end tend to rein them in. So it may well be the case that the extremists in the Iranian government wanted Nasrallah to carry out a serious second front attack on Israel. And the pragmatists said, you know what, enough is enough, because if we do that, it's quite obvious the Americans, the British and the Israelis will understand where that came from, and we will have our heads on the block before you know it. I think it's also fair to say that Nasrallah himself is both a pragmatist and an extremist. I think that the years in which he has gradually managed to take control of swathes of the Lebanese parliament and chunks of the Lebanese economy mean that he also has plenty of rational skin in the game and what to lose, therefore. One of the other small points that I wonder is that we talk about how we know that 150,000 rockets have been transferred to Hezbollah over the years. But it does occur to me that actually, on the same basis as most weaponry tends to degrade when it's just sitting in storage, and especially with Hezbollah, where they don't exactly have American-grade storage facilities for this stuff, it seems fairly likely to me that actually that 150,000 rocket threat is probably a substantially lower threat than we want to say, or that they want to say. A small mercy. So at least for now, it seems like Hezbollah are broadly sitting this out, other than throwing the minimum number of rockets and attempted border incursions that they can to make it look like there's some sense of pan-Arab unity. In reality, Shiites and Sunnis hate each other almost as much as they collectively hate Jews. And this is just a reminder that, of course, the Palestinians are Sunni and Hezbollah and Iran are Shiite. So who else might join in? The obvious then question is, what's happened to the rest of the Palestinians, the ones in the West Bank under Abbas and the Palestinian Authority? Abbas has managed to equivocate fairly strongly so far, so he has yet to condemn what Hamas did in any real terms. And it seems to me that he's playing a little bit of a hedging game. He does not want to end up on the wrong side of the Saudis if at the end of this it turns out that the Saudis now do a deal with Israel, because that's going to represent the best opportunity to continue to grift and steal money from international aid and rebuilding projects. It's very likely that Abbas in some form will end up being handed some of the keys to Gaza, because we just have nobody else to ask, however frustrating that is. So I think he's just waiting to see which side of the grift he's going to play. The reality is that if he was serious about a two-state solution, as so many naive people in the West seem to think, he had a golden opportunity on the 7th of October to say, however much we don't like Netanyahu, however much we begrudge the actions of the State of Israel and how difficult they've made it for us to be a peace partner, this is too far. That would not have been a difficult sentence for him to say, and his silence and his inability to say that should ring out very clearly, more than any words he can or did or will say on the subject. Of course, he couldn't possibly just say he was pro-Hamas, because unless we are at a point where Hamas really inflict a long-term defeat on Israel, and the point at which it looks like all of the deals with the rest of the Arab world are dead, and perhaps even people drop out of the Abraham Accords de facto or de jure, he doesn't want to be on the losing side, so he's just been hedging his bets so far. Not so Turkey, who have absolutely jumped on board with the whole Hamas thing, to the extent that Erdogan has been pretty gleeful. He's refused to say that they're terrorists. In fact, he's done the opposite. He's doubled down on his enthusiasm for dead Jews. Israelis had to very hastily leave Turkey in the first couple of weeks after everything kicked off. And this should be seen in its context of Turkey fully realigning to BRICS, and that probably ought to be calling into question whether they can retain their membership of NATO at this juncture. Then, of course, you have Qatar, who are major non-NATO allies and hosts to a serious American naval base. And it seems quite clear to me that the Americans have told them in no uncertain terms, when this is done, you need to stop playing both sides. You cannot continue to be the Switzerland of the Middle East and have all of this American benefit and our blood and treasure being spent to make sure that you continue to be safe, whilst you are also bankers to these Islamo-Nazis. Just isn't going to work. So I would expect that at the end of this, although I don't imagine it will be de jure, I think de facto Qatar will end up just sitting on the sidelines of any future Middle East conflicts. So what would I have done? This actually ties into my analysis of what I think we were being prevented from going ahead with, which is this enlargement of the Abraham Accords to include Saudi Arabia and putting the Abraham Accords countries at the center of this alternative to Belt and Road. And hopefully, whatever ends up at the end of this conflict is going to look much like what we should have had before it, and that these countries are going to double down and say, you know what, this proves why we needed to do this, and we're not going to be intimidated off the right course here. At this juncture, it is certainly the only thing that is going to allow Netanyahu to retire with a shred of decency and credibility. So, as I say, the bit I was wrong about is that I believed it was necessary to make a feint towards Gaza and then deal with Hezbollah because they seemed like such an obvious threat. And I was also very concerned about a serious uprising within the West Bank, partly because Abbas had done so little to speak out in no uncertain terms about what was going on. Thank goodness I seem to have been wrong on both of those counts, which is a great relief. Especially given that on a clear day, I can see the hills of Judea and Samaria from the rooftop of my apartment next to the beach in Tel Aviv. It's not one that I wanted to be right about. What would I have done in terms of Gaza? My view was that, firstly, we needed to seal off the border completely on the Egyptian side, because although it is a technically closed border, it's quite apparent that Hamas have been able to arm using terror tunnels or by smuggling things in with whatever aid shipments they've been supposed to get through the crossing from Egypt, and that potentially also the naval blockade has not been as effective as it might have been, presumably because access via Egyptian waters has been something of a soft touch. We don't quite know all of that yet, that's just speculation, but it seems quite obvious that all of this equipment has got in somehow, and it certainly isn't coming from Israel. I think that if we had sealed the Egyptian border by retaking the Philadelphia corridor, and therefore actually have managed to completely encircle Gaza, and I know the word besiege has a lot of connotations, but yes, besiege Gaza properly, not the BS version. You know, the number of times that everyone cries wolf and says it's a siege when it's not, let's give them a real siege. I think we should have hermetically sealed the border. And then we should have, instead of bombing 2,500 targets, which is apparently what we did, which was always going to give plenty of excuses to everyone to pile on to us, despite the fact that we were the wronged party. This was a chance to build up a coalition to try and cover the obvious civilian and humanitarian problems that were going to occur as soon as we put boots on the ground or even carried out the necessary precision bombing of known Hamas targets. I shan't get into a lengthy treatise on the various rules of war. I would refer you instead to my great friend Natasha Hausdorff and the UK Lawyers for Israel series on YouTube, which you can find about various of these issues, but I will just raise one or two of them here. The first is that pretty much anything can be considered a legitimate target if the other side is using those sites, such as hospitals and schools and UN compounds, in a manner which makes them into targets. Once they've been told to stop and fail to do so, then those places become military targets just like everything else. And I know it's problematic and I know it's morally traumatizing for us because we all hate the idea that we've just bombed a school or bombed a hospital or put soldiers on the ground in a UN compound or whatever it is. But these are not schools, hospitals, and UN compounds as we know it in the West. There is a legal concept in war called perfidy, which is exactly like it sounds, where your enemy is perfidious, where they are not a regular army, but they are acting exactly as Hamas, Hezbollah, and others are doing so, by not just hiding in, but fully enmeshing themselves within the civilian infrastructure as a strategy by design from the get-go. This is not the case of just slinking back inside these houses so that it's difficult for the Israelis to separate civilians from terrorists. This is building the goddamn houses with the tunnels underneath them so that this is always going to be the entrapment that Israel finds itself in. This idea of trying to build the coalition before you go in is to try and make very clear to the various partners that we are facing a perfidious enemy and that we need everybody to confront this enemy and to try and help those people who we do consider to be innocent civilians who are capable of being physically saved and eventually mentally saved from the years of brainwashing into extremism that unfortunately the entirety of Gaza has been subject to, hence all of these opinion polls showing that the majority actually support Hamas and support what happened on the 7th of October and would love it to happen again, but we still have a duty of care towards those people. It's impossible for Israel to exercise that duty of care during and after a war entirely on its own, despite the various protocols that Israel puts into place, the warnings and the usual roof-knocking, SMS, phone calls, whatever it takes to try and save civilians, and also, of course, warn Hamas and give them lots of time to just leave whatever building they're hiding in. I think all of that should have been left for a later date. It seems to me that we missed a huge opportunity to turn around to the Western world and say, we know that you're going to cry wolf. We know that you're going to blame us for having the temerity to defend ourselves and to live through this crisis that is not of our making. So we're going to give you, the world, 7 days in which we're going to work with you to hash out the solution to this problem. The non-negotiables from our perspective are all of our hostages back and no more Hamas at the end of it. How do you wish us to go about this? And that was the real opportunity. And if you'd have ended up in the middle of this crisis, turning around and creating a de facto peace process with the Saudis and with other Arab states in the name of agreeing that this was beyond the pale and that what needed to happen was the removal of Hamas and the return of our hostages, then it would already have been a triumph and you would start to lock in allies almost regardless of how the war would then be conducted. And one of the big things is that we need these other parties to help us to conduct this war properly. We need somebody else to be responsible, but to have enough skin in the game to get all of these food trucks and whatever other resources are needed into Gaza in a way that doesn't continue to bolster Hamas. The same with electricity, the same with water, the same with fuel supplies at the hospitals, all of that kind of stuff. We all know that Hamas is playing everyone. Hamas is asking for it with a smirk on their face because they know full well that the agenda of far too many people is to go along with their Goebbels-esque lies. It only takes having a look at people who actually have a reasonable amount of knowledge of this stuff to see their reaction to this problem. So you have, you know, the Egyptian prime minister on record saying, I would rather endless numbers of dead in Gaza than a single living Palestinian coming into Egypt. Or you have Bernie frickin' Sanders, who says, no, there should definitely not be a ceasefire. This is not the time for a ceasefire, not until the hostages are back and Hamas is destroyed. This should tell you what is really going on here. You have to be absolutely doolally, and unfortunately it turns out that far too many people are, to continue to support Hamas and to believe that Hamas are supposed to be speaking for the Palestinian people, albeit plenty of surveys show that currently, unfortunately, the Palestinian people do think that Hamas speaks for them. Now, we're in a war situation. We're supposed to differentiate between civilians and civilians who support Hamas and regular active Hamas members. That's going to be a challenge. These are the kind of challenges that we shouldn't have had to face as alone as we did. But that would have required some really cool heads to prevail and to not just reach for the bomb our latest Hamas targets in Gaza button, which is what they did, with the inevitable consequences of killing enough people who are not provably Hamas terrorists that we are beginning to lose the battle for world opinion. We've already lost the battle for the loudest opinions on the world streets. And in terms of what the average person thinks, they are rapidly being manipulated against us. And it is only by the grace of God that we have got enough world leaders who know which way is up and continue to back our cause. And all of this seems to me to have been somewhat avoidable, or at least to be structured so that blame would not solely land squarely on Israel's shoulders by not rushing in the first place in the way that we did. Now, of course, it's very easy to say this, as I said, with hindsight and as an amateur, but I think we needed to have thought about this in much more dynamic and innovative terms than we did. It would have allowed us to dictate what the end of conflict might actually look like. It also would have allowed us to take a moral high ground at the point at which we needed to carry out levels of bombing that are inevitably going to lead to large numbers of civilian deaths and to substantial destruction of all infrastructure in Gaza. And let's face it, it is all dual use on some level because Hamas have made it so. In the end, Hamas will capitulate if we are left to our own devices. So the key problem was always, how do you make sure that we are left to our own devices? And the best two ways that I could see to go about that were either to engage the rest of the world in agreeing that the solution is whatever it is that we plan to do militarily and agree in advance and publicly, and then to buy yourself the moral space to do whatever work is necessary with whatever collateral damage that entails, tragic as it may be. Or for powers that be that are substantially larger than Israel to be able to step in and say, okay, Hamas, you guys have got to go, you're going into exile, this is the basis, these are the names of the people we want to see walk out of the door. If Israel was able to find this many targets, and if Israel is sophisticated enough to know where the various Hamas members are, they're sophisticated enough to have a list of those Hamas members. So the alternative was to do something a bit like a Black September, but hopefully with not quite as much bloodshedding before, which is to simply turf out this leadership to a country that will have it. I would imagine that country should be Iran, and I get what the risk is. Yes, we've just got rid of the entire lot of these people and they've gone somewhere else where they're free to act again. But in practice, it doesn't matter how many of these people you kill, the idea will live on. And the main thing that we're trying to achieve here is to get the hostages back and to secure our border properly. These are then people who have no chance to re-enter Gaza. Hopefully we can stop them from re-entering the West Bank. And at least that point, their presence is just fundamentally illegal. That would seem to me to have been a substantial gain. The problem is that we had, and I understand why, a bloodlust. We needed to kill the people who killed us. And I think that has clouded our judgment and put us in a very difficult position. It's not to say we wouldn't have killed these people at some other point, but if you want to take the moral high ground, at least give the world a chance to resolve this without the bloodshed. We already know that before the bodies were cold on 7/10, we were already being criticized for a war we had not yet prosecuted. This to me seems to have been a way in which we could have tried to sidestep that issue. To be clear, I don't believe that we would have rallied together in 7 days, a coalition of active participants in prosecuting a war against Hamas. But what we would have done is bought ourselves a lot more diplomatic breathing room, not just the 7 days that would have occurred from the 7th to the 14th of October, but the time that we need now in December, January, as we are trying to resolve this problem on an ongoing basis. It would also have let us and humanitarian organizations and other governments prepare the ground for the inevitable civilian crisis that occurred. And that would have made our logistical position during fighting an awful lot easier, and certainly easier for us to quite legitimately exert more firepower without such risk to civilians as inevitably we have had to take, with the resultant loss of life that absolutely needs to be put squarely on the shoulders of Hamas. Although it would only have been a technical exercise because, of course, Hamas would have rejected it, our opportunity was to say, either you leave now, or this is going to be the consequence. Either you give us back the hostages, or this is going to be the consequence. There was no ultimatum that was delivered, as far as I know, through the international community to Hamas to say, you know you've gone and done it this time, and there is no upper limit to the action that we're going to carry out in response. So you need to do this. And if we'd have done that, and again, publicly done that, it's all about buying ourselves the breathing room, much as it is unbelievably unjustified and frustrating that we have to do everything with one hand tied behind our back, standing on one leg, and in the incredible scrutiny of the world's media and the judgment of all of the right on. But that is our lot. What happens when this war is over? I think it's worth stating quite clearly that this doesn't present a classic existential threat to Israel, but it does present a serious threat to the way of life that we knew. We were already at, I think, a crossroads for many largely young, upwardly mobile, broadly what we would call left-leaning Israelis who were getting tired of living there anyway. Cost of living crisis, downturn in the tech sector, coupled with the straw that was breaking the camel's back already over judicial reform and the wider direction of the country, a sense of a drift away from pluralism and towards ideology as the driving force of the state. And then, of course, the failure of the state to actually protect its citizens, the very raison d'etat of Israel. And I think that it is going to be an uphill struggle to stop there being the kind of brain drain that we saw in the 1970s from Israel. I think that it would only take the wrong 1% of the population to decide that they want to have at least 1 foot outside the country, as, for example, I do, for the whole country to just drop below critical mass in terms of its innovation, which is what is driving 40%, 50% of its exports, which is obviously the technology community. What we need to have at the end of this is a serious peace process, not necessarily with the Palestinians, but with the wider Arab world. If you guys don't want this to happen again, then you need to all join us so that we can be equally responsible for what goes on. There's been some talk about a kind of Middle Eastern NATO, which would have to involve Israel for it to have any serious clout and for it to be not run by Iran or Turkey. And I think that kind of thing, at least de facto, is going to become a reality in any well-structured process for recovering our little piece of the Middle East. We need the Saudis and other Arab states to be heavily involved in the rebuilding of Gaza because they need to have skin in the game for the next time that Hamas or Fatah or whoever it is decides that they don't like the status quo and that violence is the answer. It needs to not be Israel, or certainly not just be Israel, that pays the price and that has to try and work out a way to combat these people in the most asymmetric warfare, especially in moral terms, that pretty much I think has ever happened to any country ever anywhere. And this brings us back round full circle to what happens with India, for example. I think that they will, at the end, still sign this land train kind of deal with Saudi, the Gulf, and Israel and Jordan, and this is just going to become an inevitability. If anything, this has been a wake-up call to the Indians, who, don't forget, have had their own Islamist massacre at huge scale in the streets of Mumbai in the not-too-distant past. And I don't think they're going to back down from the position that they're currently in. I don't think that they're going to be cowed by this kind of terrorism. They're going to understand that this was a veiled threat from their own partners within BRICS. I said quite early on that one of the solutions in Gaza is inevitably going to be the presence of forces that are not Israeli and are not or not purely from the Palestinian Authority. And it seems to me that the United Nations, although it is largely discredited as far as Israel is concerned, will have to play a role, and that the compromise will be that UN soldiers on the ground will be provided by India. It seems inevitable that we must also maintain control of the border with Egypt, which means the Philadelphia corridor has to remain at least somewhat in Israeli hands, unless we can find partners that we really trust to maintain and monitor the border as it's supposed to be. Then there's a question of day-to-day governance of the Palestinians. It seems that we're coming to the end of Abbas's enormously long premiership and life, but the likelihood is that we are just going to end up coming under pressure to release Marwan Barghouti to become their leader. And he's going to be greeted as if he's Nelson fucking Mandela, which he absolutely is not. This is a man with the blood of Israelis on his hands. But he may be the best we have, and then we have a decision to make. Are we really going to empower this guy, or do we need to try and find some alternatives? Realistically, those alternatives cannot come from within Israel. They're going to come from other Arab states who provide all of the necessary funding and functionaries and structures so that the Palestinians can rule themselves and try and work out a new form of their own leadership, as opposed to us trying to cobble something together from parties that we know to be totally inimical to our long-term values. I think that there may be a kind of third way that we might consider, which is to change the rubric of what is the PA. So if we can separate out Fatah, which are not that far behind Hamas in terms of much of their rhetoric, and the Palestinian Authority as a technocratic and bureaucratic organization, perhaps that's the way that one handles this. So you might leave Mahmoud Abbas in charge of the Palestinian Authority because he's a nominal figurehead that the rest of the world seems happy to deal with. And then what you actually put into place as a kind of franchise is an administration which can be run by some very carefully vetted, less extreme Palestinians, of which there are plenty, who actually are fairly competent, boosted by support from the international community, and you essentially build the organization on the fly. You start it out as something which may be majority not Palestinian run, but that can become so, and you do it under the franchise of what you would call the Palestinian Authority. You then need to make it quite clear to those people who are currently the franchisees of the Palestinian Authority, such as Fatah, if you wish to be a part of this, then firstly, it's not going to be as corrupt as you've been used to. The days of lining your pockets are over. And secondly, you will need to make the correct public statements about peace and side by side and working towards some kind of solution, whatever it might be, two state or more complex than that. And again, that's the subject of an entirely different podcast. That might even, God forbid, allow a new figure such as a Barghouti to become the head of what is notionally called the Palestinian Authority, even though the organization itself has nothing to do with him and he has very little day-to-day control over it. I hate to say this, but most people are really effing stupid. They don't actually understand when the UN is really the UN and when it's something else. They don't understand whether the PA is the PA or whether it's something else. So this is just a marketing exercise. And, you know, of course, I'm assuming that this podcast is listened to just by my own friends and family. So maybe you heard it here first. Keep it to yourselves, eh? I think, as ever in the world of politics and diplomacy, there's a need to be seen to be doing certain things, and in practice, other things are happening below the surface. I guess that's what I'm really trying to get at here. In effect, that's exactly what Bibi was doing before the 7th of October. Whilst in public, he was quite rightly condemning Hamas as a terrorist organization that sought our destruction, what happened in practice was that he maintained them as long as they maintained the status quo. So I'll conclude here. You've been with me for an hour. I appreciate it. What I'm getting at overall is that whilst this is a really awful situation, I don't believe that Hamas did this entirely on their own and that the timing was completely arbitrary. The reason that they did this is to prevent something bigger happening that was in Israel's enormous interests and the interests of, in fact, the entire Western world. Giving Hamas a victory would be not just to leave them in power, not just to leave behind our hostages, but to take that off the table. Giving Israel a victory will be not just, therefore, the removal of Hamas and the rescue of as many of our hostages as we can, but it will be to build a new Middle East based on the model that we were trying to get to, a peace with Saudi Arabia, which would lead to a de facto de jure peace, or at least stability of a situation with most of the wider Muslim and Arab world, and that the Saudi-India initiative would go forward that would put Israel directly on the path from India to Europe, and that that would also be in the interests, ironically enough, of the Palestinians, and especially in the light of this war, which of course has caused untold damage to Gaza. This is the one opportunity Gaza really has to be rebuilt on a much better basis and for its people to show that they really are innocent and that they really do want to live a better life and that they really are capable of living alongside their neighbors. And that is a multi-generational process, but it has to start with the buy-in of ordinary Israelis and of people around the world in these various constituent countries of this rather large plan that seems to have been afoot, that we all are pulling in the same direction. And I hope that's an optimistic note to finish on. I don't feel on a day-to-day basis particularly optimistic, but I'm hoping that in the long run, this is where we're going to end up. And that as best as it can be, perhaps all of this was worth it, because this was the last threshings of a terrorist organization, and perhaps even this was the last hurrah of some of the horrific larger parties that sit behind that organization to try and prevent I hate to use this because it gets manipulated, but a world order that we would all recognize as being a new iteration of the Pax Americana that we've experienced for the last couple of generations, and that we can therefore go forward on the basis of a new, still quite multipolar world, but one in which Israel is vastly more secure, one in which the West cannot be held to ransom by some of the most despicable regimes imaginable, and one in which the Palestinians can actually work out which side they would rather be on, and that they choose the right side for once. We can only hope. In the next episode, I'm going to dive pretty heavily into what happens on the Israeli side after the war and a little bit of thinking about how we got into this situation in the first place on a deep level within Israeli society. And the problems I'm going to talk about there are ones that many of you who've known me long enough will know that I've been bitching and moaning about for the better part of a decade. In the meantime, Shabbat Shalom, Merry Christmas to those who celebrate it, and a happy and better New Year to all of us.